Welcome to the Scottish FA Power of Football podcast series. We are delighted to welcome back Gordon Waddle, respected journalist with a number of years' experience across the Scottish game and a huge advocate of grassroots and community football and sport. Gordon, welcome.
Thanks for having me again.
For the listeners in the series, we touched upon a huge amount of topics, I think, in the last episode. We talked about football's ability and sport's ability to connect. And this episode, we really want to start focusing on that element beyond the pitch. And one of the first things I'd like to talk to you about is role models. So when you were growing up, who did you look up to and why?
Oh, dear. I mean, there were so many aspects to that question. You know, I mean, it's funny, we use the word role models and we talk about football players, and I think sometimes we unfairly burden them with it. And I'm not just talking about football here, we're talking about all sports, but, you know, if we have an expectation on people to have a certain set of behavioural traits or, you know, whatever you want to call them, that, you know, then I think we're probably in this day and age asking for trouble, that you're going to end up being let down by them at some point, on, you know, within some framework, I think. So I think it's unfair sometimes to burden them by saying you're a role model, so live up to it. I think, but what you want and the people that you want to look up to are people that set their own standards for themselves. You know, and who have leadership skills, who have communication skills, who do all the right things. You know, so I mean, it's been really interesting. I don't know if you guys have been watching The Last Dance on Netflix, a Michael Jordan documentary, and you look at him, and Michael Jordan was one of my all-time sporting icons as a mad basketball head. You know, I love the sport, and I loved him. But watching that documentary, it's quite revealing as to, you know, you hold him up as a role model. Is that quite dangerous, because he was. So obsessive with winning, and so can, you know, and at any cost, there was an element, you know, to him. So, and a lot of the stuff that you were watching made for quite uncomfortable viewing. So, is he a role model, or is his behavior something you should aspire to, i.e., just being a winner, or is it about more than that? And the way his leadership kind of dragged people along with him, but not always voluntarily. So, I find it's a really interesting thing to examine. I mean, To go back to the original question, as a kid, when it came to football, my early heroes were Falkirk players. The first guy I ever wanted to be was Ali Donaldson, who was the goalkeeper for Falkirk when I started seriously watching Falkirk. He went on to play for Dundee, you know, terrific goalkeeper. But the first strip I ever had was an Ali Donaldson replica kit, which was one of these, like, it was like made out of mohair, just about, you know, it was that long ago. But
it wasn't allowed to get wet. If it got wet,
it weighed about 4 tons when you played in the rain. But it's funny, I ended up much later in life meeting him. We hosted a golf tournament with the Sunday Mail, and Ali was one of the qualifiers for the final, and he turned up, and one of these things that you always think that your hero is a colossus when you're a kid, you know, you just look at them, and it actually turned out, especially for a goalkeeper, he wasn't that big a guy, he wasn't that tall. When I met him, you kind of look and say, my memories of you are that you were like, you know, 7 feet tall, you know, and just because it's just the way you see things as a kid sometimes, isn't it? But from a football point of view, you know, I worship the ground that Falkirk players walked on from other sports. You know, there were guys. There's a guy called Richard Jewell who was the number one table tennis player in Scotland at the time, and he was a class operator and a brilliant guy. And he's now, ironically enough, the chief exec of Table Tennis Scotland. And I still can speak to him and keep in touch with him. And he was a guy that everybody wanted to play like him, and everybody wanted to be like him at the time. You know, because he was a gentleman. And there were, you know, there were various other guys who were mentors to me, and right through that period of time, not least obviously my father, who was a huge influence in my life. You know, you look at role models and who you want to be in life, and he was most of it. And I'm pretty sure that most people would probably say that about their parents if they've inspired them in any way.
I get, you know, and I think you're right, you know, like putting people up on a pedestal is an interesting trait, particularly elite sportsmen, because because they have to have such a drive and ambition to go and do things. I think what was really interesting for me is that I've got two daughters, and my eldest daughter was not interested in playing football at all, really, you know, despite my wife and I both being in love with the game. And we took her along to a Scottish international game. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, at the end of the games, all the players come over to the touchline and they speak to all of the attendees, and they sign autographs and they get their pictures taken. And my wife very luckily knew a number of the players, including Christy Murray. And Christy actually signed my daughter's top and took a picture with her. And then after that, from that day onwards, she's basically wanted to play football, and it's been what her aspiration. And I think there's a huge thing about people being able to see the role model and aspire to them, and then they can relate to them. And I think because they do that, then they want to take part in sport. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, listen, that's a massive thing. It's funny, I mean, like the current Falkirk captain, Gregor Buchanan, lives just over the wall from us, and my wee fella... as you know, if he's out bouncing up and down his trampoline, like you'll see him and he'll shout over the wall at him and kind of wave to him and stuff like that. And it's these are the kind of things that you think, that's great. You want good guys and strong leadership figures in your life, and your, you know, to be able to look up to. And I still have a fear sometimes of attaching that responsibility to people if it's, you know, if it's not voluntary, if you don't necessarily want to be that guy. I remember a couple of times over my career, I've written strong things about Scott Brown, for example. Now, Scott Brown has emerged into a terrific leader and captain of Celtic and all that, but he's had his moments, obviously, when he was, you know, a younger guy, you know, like, you know, the one with the week before the League Cup final when Ronnie Dyla was a manager, when he was, you know, found face down in a pizza supper in Edinburgh after a night out. And you're thinking, and again, you're right about that at the time, you think, well, is it fair that we burden this guy with the expectation that everybody is going to be a Billy McNeil who wears the Celtic captain's armband and can carry that responsibility to have everybody look up to him? Is that, you know, is it unfair that sometimes guys just want to be guys or girls just want to be girls when it comes to it? Yeah. And again, I go back to the fact that the truth is that you will respect people who set standards for themselves and then live up to them. You know, and I think that if you look at, I think the Scottish women's team is brilliant at doing that. I think that I've seen it myself when they've been playing or doing training sessions at our stadium at Falkirk, and you see their interaction with their fans. I think to a certain extent they realised that they kind of had to do that. Because the women's game needs as much publicity as it can get, because it's not seen as being on a par with the men's game. So they understand that the goodwill that's engendered from that they're going to benefit from that. I think Shelley's very smart at realising that as well. So from that point of view, just you're right. I think that kind of thing can only inspire another generation of kids. When they've got that kind of close contact, and you're looking, and they make their training sessions open, you know, to local kids to come and watch and stuff like that. It was the same when the Davis Cup came. You know, you want to look for a role model in Scottish life. Look at Andy Murray in Scottish sporting life. You know, I mean, Andy Murray has to be our generation's. You know, I mean, he's an absolute god when it comes to that kind of stuff. Not only is he an elite, and by elite I mean absolute top of the tree world class sportsman, he's also a world class guy when you look at his attitudes towards equality and racism and mentoring kids. And you know, so when the Davis Cup came to town and they did all the stuff for the school kids round about you know, that and the Emirates, and they were engaged in it all, he's exactly what you want from a role model, you know, somebody that you can look up to. And you know, There's nothing to hang on Andy Murray that you can look at and say, oh, well, I don't really want to look up to him because he's this or he's that. He's everything that he should be.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you're right, from an elite sports person's point of view, you know, the ability to inspire a generation for people to take part in sports is absolutely huge. And you're right, you know, sometimes they don't, I think we unfairly, you know, label them as role models, and it might just be the fact that they are just inspirational characters for one way or another. Yeah.
Perhaps. Some of them are capable. Listen, Danny, some of them are capable of living up to it. You know, I mean, like, look at the world of golf at guys like Paul Laurie and Stephen Gallagher and their foundations and the work that they do with kids in their area, you know, in Aberdeen or in, you know, in East and Central Scotland, but in Stephen's case. And, you know, I mean, they're fantastic role models, you know, and they use their status and professionalism to engage kids in their sport, but also to inspire them as well. And they do it in a charitable way as well, because it's, you know, they make golf accessible to a lot of kids who otherwise wouldn't necessarily get access to it.
Yeah. So and to just to extend that then, so you know, we've got those people at that side of the game as well. And you talked about people who, you know, live their life through the values that they live, they lead. So from a grassroots and a community aspect, you know, what's the type of traits they think that people pick up from, you know, their role models at that grassroots level? You know, the grassroots coach and somebody who volunteers the gazillion hours a week, you know, week in, week out. And, you know, you talked about it in the previous podcast, it's perhaps been there for 40 years at the club. You know, what's the type of thing that they do that offer that kind of off-pitch element beyond the pitch?
There's so many facets to it. I mean, I think I mentioned in the first part of the podcast that the fact that a lot of these people aren't just there to teach you football, they're there to teach you life. And I think, you know, one of these kind of common traits that I always find with these guys isn't that they're hard asses or, you know, or, you know, I mean, they want discipline, but they get it in a way that brings it out of kids rather than forces it into them. You know, the first question, it's funny, it's always the first question that I endeavoured to ask. And it maybe ties in a lot with, say, the positive coaching Scotland ethos of, you know, the first question I would always ask the wee man when he comes away from a training session or a game of golf or whatever it is, did you enjoy that?
Yeah.
And it's not, did you win, did you lose, it's did you enjoy it? And there are so many of these coaches that I've come across within the grassroots game or who run clubs or whatever that's what they're there for. They're there to put a smile on a kid's face, no questions asked. They don't ask for anything in return other than that kind of sense of, right, I've put on a session there for kids for an hour and a half or a couple of hours, or I've opened the gates for kids to go out there and play football, and they're all coming off laughing and smiling and joking, and, you know, and all right, you know, kids love to win, they hate to lose, same as most of us do. Yeah, but
absolutely.
It's not the point. And, you know, I mean, if that's all that ever drove anybody that ran a kids' football club, then most people wouldn't turn up, you know, because it shouldn't be what it's all about. And the humility of most of these people, again, is a very endearing trait. The lack of desire to be given credit or to take credit for what they do.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're the voluntary sector it's not just a Scottish phenomenon, it's a worldwide phenomenon, but the notion of football without volunteers, putting things on a plate for kids to get them into the game and enjoy the game, I can't imagine any version of the game that would ever survive without that benevolence, if you like, you know. And we talked about it a bit in the first part of the podcast, but the Grassroots Awards, over what now we've been 17 years, and we must have, well, how many people have been up on stage on any given night? We've probably put 20 or 30 people at Hampden times 17, so you're talking kind of up to around about 500 people we've given a reward to, and the first thing to acknowledge is the fact that for every one of them there are dozens of others whose nominations we considered that were just as dedicated and just as liked and just as revered, but, you know, you've got to choose a winner out of them, and that's the thing you've got to remember, is that the country revolves around, and sorry, the sporting country revolves around its volunteer effort, and I think absolutely. that in a football sense particularly, there are a lot of traits, but that aspect of their humility and their desire not to be, you know, not to be front and centre of it is such an important one.
I do. I agree wholeheartedly as well. And I still remember, I think it's very much like your teachers. You know, you remember your teachers, the ones that cared about you, the ones that took the time. And I think from my memories as well, as growing up playing football at grassroots, I still remember the coaches who took the time and the effort aside, you know, beyond, you know, just to make sure we get looked after as a person more than a player. And I think that's the big thing. And
every time we launched the Grassroots Awards, I think I mentioned this, that I did an interview with a big star, you know, whether it was a Darren Fletcher or Andy Robertson or, you know, Gordon Strachan or whoever it was, Walter Smith, and they would all be able to tell you, and they were all able to tell you, the first guy who got a ball down in front of their feet and actually inspired them, you know, and taught them something, whether it was their school Johnny or their PE teacher or a guy at the boys' club, you know, and they all spoke passionately and lovingly about that guy or that woman who was the person that put them on the path. And they all remember it. You know, none of them, no matter how high up the ladder you climb, no matter whether you're Andy Robertson, you're a European Cup winner, you're a worldwide superstar, but you still remember the guy. It was interesting. I mean, he's not in the squad anymore, but I remember doing a piece with Akechi Anya when he got his first Scotland cap. He got the kit man to print him three extra versions of his strip, and he went back down the road and presented the three guys, his three coaches throughout his boys' club era, each with his own Scotland strip signed with his name on the back, just because he felt they deserved it, they deserved the credit, which I thought, you know, it's just that kind of, that's not, you know, I suppose some people might say, well, it's gesture politics or whatever, but to me, it was just the way he talked about it, it was straight from the heart, you know, and he appreciated the fact that he would never have been where he was without them putting him on the path. So that kind of stuff really, you know, I think that's its own reward.
And I totally agree. And I think one of the things that's been most humbling as well, and really, and I've worked at the association for a number of years now, like, we are immensely proud of the fact that the game's becoming more and more diverse. You know, there's more para-football athletes and players and volunteers involved in the game. We've touched, we've talked actually privately about Football Memories and the fantastic project, the Sport Memories, that's delivered across Scotland as well. And I think there's more of an opportunity, and I think it links into the whole role models idea that, you know, people are now seeing that there's more opportunities to consume the game in one way, shape or form than has ever happened and before. And what do you think then, you know, from your experiences, you know, seeing that the growth of para football and seeing the growth of Football Memories, what's the real value then with these types of projects and programmes?
The way that these things metamorphose and kind of diversify from where they start, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think if we probably did in the very first Grassroots Awards have a disability football award. I think we did. And it was a very, I felt at the time, like a very narrow field. And then you kind of fast forward 15, 16, 17 years to what it had become, and the broad diversity of projects that are there to help people engage in football that otherwise wouldn't be able to engage. You know, I mean, a couple of, you know, you talk about examples, and, you know, we talk about the Frame Football at Partick Thistle, and you know, I think who kind of effectively started that kind of movement and got people involved in that, and it blossomed. But the one that sticks in my head from recent years was a lady called Anne Brown, who we put up on stage. And she had this project called Team United, which was run out of West Lothian, I think, a Broxburn kind of way. And it worked specifically at first with helping kids with autism, who maybe struggled in the mainstream aspect of youth football, who maybe were, you know, were decent players, or who wanted to participate but struggled in the environment of a dressing room or a big club or whatever. But this project that she started running gave them an avenue. Honestly, some of the testimonials that we got from parents towards Anne at the time when she was being nominated, Anne eventually won that award. Anne was shortlisted for Local Hero in the Sports Awards the following year, I think, from memory as well. Honestly, they brought a tear to your eye. The life-making difference, the difference, you know, I mean, their kids suddenly were able to find a haven for themselves to play football, where other people were able to kind of, you know, understand them, give them their space if they needed it, but, you know, whatever it was that they required from it, there was an understanding there. And it's interesting because and a lot more clubs and foundations now are doing CAMS work, you know, child and adolescent mental health service stuff, and it's one of these things. I mean, I pointed our guys in the direction of Anne for, you know, for advice and help if you know, if they were looking for it to how to deal with stuff like that. You know, and it's the breadth of that movement now suddenly makes it mainstream.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. You know, I mean, from we used to kind of ghettoise that as a, you know, in the same way that we probably ghettoised girls' football as well, as a kind of like a tiny little offshoot.
Yeah.
And you know, look at what it's become. But and it's the same. I mean, again, I think you had mentioned walking football earlier on, or in the first part of the podcast. I mean, Gary McLaughlin, talk about a force of nature. The guy who chairs that, you know, and he's won a UEFA award for his work as well. But I think he tells a story about how, you know, one of his participants' wives came up and spoke to him about the fact that his intervention, or walking football's intervention, had prevented her husband from, you know, making an attempt on his own life because his mental health was so poor. And yet he found this, again, I use the word haven, a haven in walking football, where he would go, participate, sit down, have a cup of tea with the boys and women afterwards, and you know, and he'd found a home from home, if you like, to deal with whatever he was going through. And the number of these stories that you hear now about football, but, you know, any aspect of football, it's the same. Stennis Muir do great mental health work, you know, within the football framework. Queen's Park, I think, have a programme like that as well.
They do.
So it's just, it's hopefully a never-ending story of football as a force for good in people's lives.
Yeah, and I know we've used the term in the past that football saves lives, and I always thought, you know, when we were putting that out to the public that, you know, we were always worried, you know, does it really save lives? But then there's more and more stories that come out. You know, the Scottish FA did a series, you know, over the last couple of years, and, you know, a couple of my colleagues were involved in it, you know, and we had Rebecca and Isla and Sarah, you know, talking about how the interventions within the game has actually helped them, you know.
Listen, I would implore anybody who's on social media to go and find Paul's video that he did. You know, your colleague, and because every time I see it surface, I like it and I retweet it, and I want more people to see it, because it's, you talk about an inspirational message, you know, and it's one of these things that I think that the more people that hear these voices, the more they'll understand.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. I think that people always often think that their community is, you know, unique, or they're, you know, they're facing those individual challenges. And And being able to get, I love to use the word haven. You know, I think football clubs, it's a wonderful phrase from terms of a community, because it's a haven for them to go and maybe escape all the other issues that are going on in their life, or just to meet people who are going experiencing the same thing as them. And I'm with you. You know, like when we first went and spoke to a lot of clubs, you know, with regards to disability football, even girls and women, a long time ago, I remember speaking to them and going, well, there's no an appetite here for this kind of stuff, son. And then slowly but surely, you know, boys clubs changed into football clubs, and football clubs turned into community clubs, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, they were just opening up more and more doors. And I think that's really reflective now that a lot of clubs are doing that. Jimmy Johnson Academy, I don't know if you saw the recent video they did, where it was with individuals who'd suffered, you know, had escaped war-torn countries and had went through kind of real significant changes within their lives and had immigrated over to the country. And they just talked about, they had helps Jim Simonette, who helped lead that. It's called Jim. So they're all shouting for Jimmy. They're all shouting for Jim. But that was a haven for them. You know, that was their place where they could go and kick a ball, and football was universal, and that was a language for them. So it's...
And there's a lot of clubs up and down the country, you know, who, where they're born in areas that are, you know, problematic in a socio-economic sense. You know, that you know, you know, I'm thinking of clubs like, oh, I don't know, for example, a Gart Cairn or something like that, who grew very quickly out of, you know, from nothing but good intentions. And I think from memory, from the last time I spoke to these guys, they were starting to branch out into other sports and you know, provide a netball team and want to do other things other than football, because there was a demand. Suddenly people in their community said, well, you've done brilliant things for our kids, you know, because life's a struggle. You've done great things for our kids in football, but can we do anything for my daughter? She doesn't really want to play football, but she's good at this, or she's good at dance, or she's good at, you know, and you're right. A lot of these clubs have realised the value lies beyond kicking a bag of air about, you know, on a grass pitch.
Aye, it's just that that's the vehicle that they bring people in, you know.
Yeah.
You're sitting, I know the listeners can't see it, but you're sitting in front of a badge there, and the Falkirk badge, and it's sitting behind you in your Zoom call.
Ever since I could, I found out that I could customise my Zoom background from the traditional bookcase and office door or whatever, then I've had my Welcome to Brockville background, and it's scabby as anything, but it's I like to think it just... Brings a smile to everybody's face anytime I do one of these things. But
like me just even saying that, like you instantly looking at that badge, and then you've got an affinity with that, and then there's so many memories that are going along with that, you know. And I remember talking to Drumchapel United, and they were talking about that as well. You know, they're the biggest show in their town. You know, like they're bigger than Rangers and Celtic in that particular area. They are the big club, you know, because that's who people want to play with, and they want to be part of that community. So I think that's the bit that clubs, I think, underestimated for a long period of time, but are now really recognising that that's the benefit.
I think a lot of football clubs now, you know, it wasn't always the case. You know, not all 42 clubs used to have, I'm saying 42, I'm talking about the senior, certainly in the senior game, the league, I feel like, had charity arms or even charitable intentions. And I think now they do. And I'm pretty sure most of them now realise the benefit of having that. You know, at first, a lot of clubs thought, we'll start a charity arm and we'll see if we can get them to filter money back into us as a club, or if that's going to be good for us as a club. And I don't think they understood the kind of moral construct of having a charity arm, a lot of them in the first instance. But now I look around at the work that so many of these organisations are doing, including my, you know, the one that I work for or volunteer for, you know, and how much good we can provide in the community. And I like to, you know, I like to hope that the intentions that these are based from filter up into the professional arm of the club. Most of them do. Most of them, you know, if you look around at most of the clubs, they are more than happy, managers, players, if there's anything that they can do to help, you know, and enhance their club's aspect and how their club deals with their community and socially and stuff like that. I mean, it's funny, I spoke... I did a thing a couple of weeks ago for the SFA doing their pro licence, and they were talking about, you know, just a kind of like how, for managers and how to deal with the media and how to deal with social media. We were talking about it, and I said, well, it's funny, a lot of people see the downside of football players being on Twitter, and they only see the confrontations and the ugly side of it. But during the lockdown, I was following a guy who I got very friendly with, Will Volks, who's now at Cardiff City, obviously. And right at the start of the lockdown, he started doing NHS charity stuff and delivering food parcels and delivering this and all that. And every day he was out doing something different, and he was using his Twitter account to publicise it and to draw attention to worthy causes. And he's you know, and we're just thinking, again, you talk about role models. I mean, that guy's, he never, when he was at Falkirk, he never said no to anything that he was asked to do, you know, what, you know, when it came to going out in the community, going to visit hospitals, going to Strathcarden Hospice, going, you know, working with the junior bairns, whatever it was. He was there. If you asked him to do it, he was there, and he was impeccably polite and brilliant at doing it. And then when he went to Rotherham, he did the same thing. He became an ambassador for a kid's home there. And now he's doing the same in Cardiff, and you're thinking, now there's somebody to look up to, but there's also an innate understanding of the role that a football club and a football player can play within a community to bring people together, and whether they're disadvantaged or, you know, or whether they're struggling with mental health or struggling just generally with their health or whatever, these guys can make a difference in your life, even if it, you know, no matter how short term it is sometimes, but they can make a difference. And you as a football organisation have to realise the power that is in that badge sometimes, that other things won't necessarily reach.
I think that's a wonderful message to leave that part of the conversation on then, Gordon. Kind of now touching on, you know, I think we've talked a huge, we've talked a lot of topics, you know, in terms of the power of the badge and the impact that the clubs are able to have and what all the programmes that they're delivering. But we're in a bit of a strange time at the moment in terms of COVID, and there's a lockdown, you know, and we have talked about what the value of football is beyond that kind of just kicking a bag of air, as you said. You know, like what do you think the future looks like as we're moving through this?
Oh, it's a tough thing to consider what the game looks like. It's hard enough to consider at the moment what the professional game is going to look like, but football in general, the one thing I hope that we take from this time is that the people involved in the game will start to understand that serving yourself is not serving anyone. You know, I mean, for too long now, Scottish football particularly has been controlled and governed by vested interests, in all aspects of the game, but particularly the professional game. But what I hope in these times of struggle is that people will realise that you need to be collaborative sometimes. You need to see a greater good beyond the end of your own nose sometimes, you know, for things to succeed. I worry, about control, and the game and power in the game, and that people maybe don't see that often enough. There's so many projects and so many things break down because it doesn't suit one individual club or one individual chief exec or one chairman. And sometimes, you know, I mean, for years, you look at the voting structure of the professional game you could basically have a two club dog with, you know, wagging a 40 club tail a lot of the time because of the voting structure, and nobody was allowed to do anything. And I hope that what this has taught us is, you know, in these times of crisis, is that if people work together to do things, then they can achieve an awful lot more. And if they understand that being a big part of something bigger is better than just sailing your ship alone and saying, you know, to hell with everybody else. So I hope that the future of the game takes a lesson from this, you know, that they're not indestructible and that no club can exist in a vacuum.
Yep.
You know, it's, again, I go back to the other thing. If people talked about, you know, they might at the start of this, clubs might go under. That would be a disaster for communities. You know, I mean, if even a single club in a single community went under, you know, it's not just the fact that these guys aren't going to be appearing at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. It's the other 6 days of the week where people rely on them as a touchstone. You know, again, and people need them to be there. So that's good. I hope as well, and it's something that we've had a conversation about, that, you know, that the grassroots game gets swept up in this as well, because I think the loss of that has been a significant thing to tens of thousands of people across Scotland. You know, the loss of having football available for kids and the teammate ethos and again, going back to the volunteers will have been struggling because, you know, the idea of life without sport for a lot of people on a daily basis is anathema. They don't, you know, it's a horrible thing, but especially for kids, and obviously having one of my own, I know how much he's missing it. And I hope that, when we come out of this, that it's one of these things that people will value what they have a little bit more.
Yeah, it's funny, like, it's a good point, because we've been talking to a lot of club leaders and clubs who, you know, right across the game, community clubs, grassroots, trusts, etc. And we've been talking about, you know, what happens post lockdown when you come out of this. And there's kind of two schools of thought. I think a lot of them are worried about, you know, the restart, and they want to do it gradually, and they want to, you know, start back in a safe manner and, you know, I think just very reflective of society. And then there's a huge swathe of clubs as well who actually think we could use this for a real positive. They think that the value of participation is actually, people are now going to do it. I think you talked about it from a golf club perspective, you know, like people just rocking up and joining for the very first time, because they now recognise how much or how integral that part of the life is. So I think there's a lot of clubs are now going to view this as saying, well, once we get back up and running, you know, we might actually be able to attract more players into the game. We might be able to attract more volunteers. It's going to be tricky, definitely, but there's maybe an opportunity for them to do something a wee bit innovative and think outside the box.
Yeah, and I think that you guys are brilliant at doing it as well, but I think there's an element of sharing best practice as well when it comes to these things. I mean, we have so many phenomenally good community clubs up and down Scotland now, and you know, the award structure that's there for them and the pathway for them to achieve you know, community status that allows them to kind of work through it to the point. And some of them serve, as you say, they serve 500, 1,000 kids in an area, or whatever. But they do it in a well structured and well organised way. They've got good leadership. They've got good fundraising. You know, I'd love to see more of them with better facilities. I think that and again, I come back to government and leadership. You know, if the government have learned anything out of this lockdown, you know, and all of that, it is people's desire. You know, I mean, that was the one thing that kind of kept a lot of people going on a daily basis was, you've got an hour's exercise, great. You know, and so suddenly people were going out on bikes or going out for a walk or going out for a run. And, you know, the government should be capitalising on that, saying, right, you know, we kind of kindled an enthusiasm for it because it was the only thing you could do. So therefore, how do we help? How do we open facilities? How do we get, and listen, I know that this is a perennial problem up and down for authorities and for football authorities and local authorities, is getting, you know, the PFI schools to open up their AstroTurf pitches instead of having locked gates on them to give people access to them, not to charge like the Light Brigade for, you know, for an hour's kids football, you know, like, and it becomes prohibitive for them. You know, there's so many things that the government could help on here, you know, and I mean national and local. We talked a bit, I can't remember if we mentioned, but I mean, we were the first club or the first foundation in the country to do a community asset transfer of a facility that our local council had, you know, had let go to the dogs. It was an old school games hall and an AstroTurf pitch that was sitting there, and it was they had given up on it basically, and they were going to shut it down. They didn't rent it out at weekends. You know, they locked the gates so that kids couldn't get access to it. Other than climbing like a 10-foot fence to try and get into play, and we eventually persuaded them and got phenomenal funding. We got like £750,000 worth of funding from a landfill tax credit scheme, which was great, and it allowed us to regenerate a town centre facility, brand new pitch, you know, a new floor in the games hall, new lights, new offices, and now it's a thriving, bustling, you know, place where it's 7 days a week there are kids taking part in football and other sports in the games hall. And, you know, that came as a collaborative effort with our council. It was harder work than it should have been to get it over the line, but it can be, we showed that it can be done. And I would love to think that national and local government should be looking at that and saying, we've got too many facilities in this country that have not been used enough. Whether it's schools or you know, or playing pitches or whatever it might be, we should be finding a way to make it easier, not harder, for kids to play sport.
Yeah, I think I agree with you in terms that there's so many innovative models that could potentially be delivered. And I've seen the Woodlands Games Hall, and I've seen it when it's mobbed with Dave Mackay and his team of coaches, and they're out there and they're delivering all the sessions, and it's a phenomenal model. And they're really innovative work. Again, just to drop a couple of clubs in, you know, like one of the things that we're really keen on is active travel to training now. You know, the public transport system might take a little bit of time to get back up to full speed. You know, can people cycle and run towards training and get down to facilities when they do that? You know, like we saw Pollock United, who had built a bike shelter just basically because the kids were asking for somebody to park their bikes to get down there. Yep. Blantyre, with their soccer academy, have got a Blantyre Bikes Better program where they can, you know, people can hire out and get access to free bikes. You know, those types of things.
Love it. That's great.
Yeah. You know, like the infrastructure going forward, I think, has got to be reflective of maybe new values that clubs have got. You know, and it's just getting give access to a club, or give access to a facility, and a club will manage it, and they'll make sure that it gets looked after properly because they've got that value attached to it, I think.
I remember going over to Denmark in, Queen of the South 2009 Scottish Cup that they finished runners-up in, was it? Yeah, it was 2008 Scottish Cup. It was 2008-2009 UEFA Cup that they played in. And they played a team called Nordsjælland in Denmark, and it's a suburb on the outskirts of Copenhagen, and we went there and to get to Farum Park you had to walk through all these facilities that were there. It was like, you know, tennis courts, basketball courts, there was an Olympic size swimming pool, there was the biggest gym in Denmark, there was squash club, table tennis club, And all these facilities were free for under 16s.
Fantastic.
And paid for by the public purse. And you're kind of looking and saying, why do we not have that? You know, why do we, as a similar kind of, you know, country with a similar climate and all that kind of stuff, why can we not, you know, have that as a model for our kids to have a genuine community sports hub in every community where everybody gravitates towards a place that they don't have to pay for, and it provides the right environment, and it creates a culture, and it creates a culture for their parents. I mean, to be fair to Sports Scotland, their community sports hubs that they have tried to bring clubs together, I think has been a brilliant idea. I think they've got a winner of them now, you know, and hundreds of them up and down the country where clubs have tried to collaborate and come together, but without that central premise of the kind of facility, the place where you all go towards. But again, we need government, we need councils. You know, I mean, everybody talked about the Icelandic model, you know, for football for a while, but that was big, clever, joined up thinking between football authorities and government and local authorities to be able to achieve what they achieved as well. And they're multi-sport. They're a multi-sport country. Their kids at the age of 10, 95% of them play more than one sport. They don't just play football. They play, you know, they play various different things. So but there's all kinds of joined up thinking needed for us to move forward. Not just talking about out of COVID, but you hope that you know, we should have been talking about this for the last two decades. Some of us have, and you feel as if you're drawn. I mean, I'm citing an example there from more than a decade ago of when I saw something like that made me think, why have we not got this? And we're still not got it. So what I'm saying is that it shouldn't just take something like a pandemic to shake us into this. It should, you know, we should already be thinking like that. But if this is what it is to have a catalyst for it, then we sure as hell got to use it.
It's a great point, and we've run out of time, Gordon. So I think it's a really great point to finish on, because it is talking about that collaboration. You know, it's people working in partnership to get to that point, and there are so many good models that we can lean on to then go and make those changes going forward. So, listen, just before we go, I just wanted to say a massive thank you to you. Without giving out your personal email or your work, your email address, or, you know, what about the Falkirk Community Foundation? If they want to hear a little bit more about what's going on there and they want to try and get in touch, what's the best way for them to be going to do that?
Well, we're in the throes of starting a new website and getting our digital presence more up and running, but we're relatively easy to find through the club's website and through the club. So we've got, and hopefully once we come out of furloughs and the pandemic and all that, we've got a brilliant staff that are eager to inspire and help as well. So they should be able to find us digitally at the moment and get themselves involved.
Great. Thanks very much. Gordon, thanks again for your time. It's been a really fascinating 2 hours talking to you over the last couple of days. So thanks again.
Thanks a lot for having me, Danny. I appreciate it.